13-25-00179CB, Burlington Resources Oil and Gas Company, LP versus Texas Crude Energy, LLC, et al.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Tiblets on behalf of Appellant Cross Appellee Burlington Resources. This proceeding involves two separate requests. In the first, Burlington asked this court to reverse the trial court's discovery sanctions order. Texas Crude requested discovery sanctions pursuant to Rule 215, a rule that by its express language applies only during the discovery process. In this case, all parties agreed not to conduct discovery. And pursuant to the party's request, the trial court entered an order staying all litigation. If a party wanted to proceed with discovery, that party was required to request a lift of the stay in the litigation. In this case, Texas Crude never requested a lift of the stay.
But they did file a motion to compel the production of documents for the audit?
Thank you, Your Honor. They actually filed a motion that they called a motion for production of information needed to complete the audit. It was not a motion to compel. It did not refer to Rule of Civil Procedure 215, nor did the motion pertain to any discovery requests. The briefing on the motion, in fact, confirmed that all parties understood there was no discovery in process.
But the judge signed an order specifying certain dates that certain information had to be produced, didn't he?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The trial court actually gave an instruction. There was never a written order that was signed. The trial court gave an instruction to produce documents, invoices, that were documents that Burlington had A, already agreed to produce, separate and apart from the agreement to audit, and B, actually were not requested in the motion for production.
Did the judge set deadlines?
He did, Your Honor.
But it was just an oral request during the hearing?
That is correct, Your
and
Honor.
So I guess I must have read, I guess it was in the motion for sanctions where the appellees specifically note the dates that the information was to be provided.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I do not plan to delve into the weeds on exactly what documents were requested when, but I do want to note that the order to produce documents only covered certain invoices, and those invoices were the only documents that the court instructed to be produced by those specific deadlines.
And were they provided?
Your Honor, with the exception of four documents, yes, they were all provided. And the uncontroverted evidence presented at the motion for sanctions is that the four documents that were later provided were not located prior to the date, the deadline specified in the court's order. They were not intentionally withheld. They were inadvertently missed. And I'll note that the Texas Supreme Court has made clear, even if a motion to compel is filed, in order to properly get sanctions related to that motion to compel, the party seeking the sanctions has the burden to prove that the documents were withheld. That's specifically discussed in the N. Ray Newkirk Logistics opinion. And in that opinion, the Texas Supreme Court noted there was no evidence. The requesting party had not provided any evidence that the responding party had intentionally withheld documents.
And whether they were intentional or whether it was inadvertent, did any of these documents affect the outcome of the merits of the case?
The invoices did not impact the outcome of the merits of the case.
In fact, Burlington prevailed in the underlying case, didn't they?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'll also note that the invoices did not pertain to transportation costs or crude oil. They pertained to natural gas liquids. So they were actually on an issue that is completely unrelated to the merits of Texas Crude's ultimate
case. Is their only complaint then that it just took 2 years and we had to hire extra lawyers and extra experts in order to complete this audit?
That is the complaint, obviously, as I noted, and we noted in our briefing, we disagree regarding the validity of the complaint. But yes, in fact, the complaint is delay only, not that evidence was destroyed or that documents were willfully withheld, which is why this case is very different from the other cases cited in the briefing in which the trial courts did impose sanctions. Affirming the trial court's sanctions order will produce illogical and unfair results. First, it will allow courts to impose sanctions under the rules of civil procedure, even when the underlying conduct is entirely unrelated to the rules of civil procedure, unrelated to discovery, and unrelated to ongoing live litigation. The trial court's order would allow parties to turn any contractual agreement to perform an audit into a sanctions fight. The second illogical result that would result from affirming the trial court's sanction order would be allowing the parties to do an end run around express contractual agreements to suspend all discovery. Both of these results contradict Texas law. Texas Crude has not provided any on-point case law that would support the trial court's sanction order. Because the trial court incorrectly determined and applied the legal principles controlling Texas Crude's sanctions request, it abused its discretion. This court should set aside the sanctions order. Now, the language in the agreement to stay is very important in this case. The parties agreed they would stay the lawsuit and would suspend all discovery and other proceedings until either the audit concluded or one or the other of the parties requested a lift of the stay. The agreement to stay explained it was entered into solely for purposes of buying peace and avoiding the continued expense, disruption, and risk to all parties of further litigation during the pendency of the audit. The trial court's order very clearly and unambiguously affected a stay in the litigation. All parties agree in this case, Texas Crude did not request discovery. The motion for production did not refer to any discovery requests, nor did it mention Rule 215 in any way. All of the briefing related to the motion for production confirms the party's understanding. Similarly, in opposing the lift of the stay, Texas Crude's counsel explained they did not want to lift the stay because the case will be back on and it will involve discovery and discovery requests and depositions, and that's what we are trying to avoid here.
And in fact, later, the stay was lifted after the hearing and the order on the sanction, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Burlington requested a lift of the stay because it had become apparent that the audit was not going to come to a conclusion. Now, the order states that the court entered the sanctions because it found that discovery abuse had occurred and that said discovery abuse was not justified. The specific reference to discovery abuse indicates that the trial court relied on Rule 215.3 in entering its order. Pursuant to this court's jurisprudence, that confines this court's review of the sanctions order to the criteria set forth in Rule 215.3. First, Rule 215.3 only applies to abuse during the discovery process. As discussed, there was no discovery process at the time of the order. Second, as discussed at length in the briefing, Burlington substantially complied with the order, did not cause Texas Crude's fees, and it would be unjust to impose sanctions pursuant to Rule 215.3 in a situation where, as here, the parties agreed not to conduct discovery. Even if the trial court referenced or relied upon Rule 215.1 in entering the order, the criteria set forth in Rule 215.1 likewise is not satisfied. The motion that Texas Crude filed was not a motion under Rule 215.1, nor did the trial court grant the motion. To the contrary, the motion asked Burlington to prepare walkthrough documents. The trial court did not grant that request. Additionally, as confirmed by the trial court's denial of the specific relief sought by Texas Crude, Burlington's opposition to the motion was justified. Lastly, for the reasons I've already discussed, it would be unjust to award sanctions under Rule 215.1.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. In its summary judgment appeal, Texas Crude contends that as a matter of law, the fees that Burlington paid under its transportation agreements are not deductible as post-production transportation costs because they do not represent the cost of transporting oil production to market. That argument is novel, and it's contrary to the plain language of Texas Crude's overriding royalty assignments and the transportation agreements themselves. It's contrary to the undisputed summary judgment evidence. It's contrary to the case law and the commentary, and consequently, this court should affirm the summary judgment. I'd like to begin with the points of law and fact that are not in dispute on the summary judgment record. There are three points of law that, after the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in an early appeal of this same case, are not in dispute. That is, one, that the overriding royalty assignments permit Burlington to deduct post-production cost. Two, that deductible post-production costs include transportation costs. And three, that transportation costs are the costs of transporting production to market. And the one crucial fact that's not in dispute is that the evidence conclusively established that without paying these so-called deficiency fees under the transportation agreements, Burlington would not have been able to transport the oil in which Texas Crude owns an interest to market for sale for the benefit of all owners. That conclusion logically follows from the transportation agreements. The plain text of it recites that Burlington is purchasing services for the transport, storage, and delivery of the oil production. And the deficiency fees make up part of the minimum price that Burlington must agree to for the pipeline and terminal owners to agree to carry that production to market. Texas Crude's briefs never dispute that those deficiency fees, without them, we would not have been able to transport.
Some of the oil gets to market. And so are those deficiency costs only attributed to the oil that gets to market?
So
in their opinion?
Their argument is that we are paying for the privilege of not transporting barrels of oil, which no court has adopted because it doesn't make sense. And the commentators, the Ottinger and Anchando articles, the scholars say that these are indeed the part of the cost of transporting the barrels of oil that you do transport, because it ensures that you will be able to get those barrels to market. The pipeline and terminal owners, they demand as consideration for agreeing to either give you capacity on their pipelines or terminals, or even building significant infrastructure to connect the well to the market, they demand as consideration a minimum price for, it's usually barrels a day, but from that barrels a day to zero, there's one minimum price. And the deficiency fee is...
So if you don't fill it, you get a deficiency cost or like a penalty for not filling your space.
The deficiency fee, Your Honor, you're correct, just trues you up to that minimum price. So you're going to be paying that minimum price no matter what, no matter if it's 5,000 barrels a day, you do 4,999, you're going to be paying the same price.
Even if you meet your requirements, you're going to be paying deficiency costs?
If you meet your requirement, you're paying the exact same transportation cost, the minimum price. It's just you don't have to use the deficiency fee calculation. It's really economically indistinguishable if they had just said the minimum price from 5,000 barrels below is X, right? Instead, they had a calculation method for truing it up to the minimum price, but it is the minimum price. And the commentators say that these are exceedingly common. They're standard industry practice. Texas Crude does not dispute that. And that without them, you cannot get secure, reliable transportation. And that the evidence showed that without firm transportation, you might not be able to drill all your wells, or you might have to shut in your wells. And in fact, at the time these transportation agreements were signed, there was a widely understood constraint on production in the Permian Basin, meaning that there was not enough transportation infrastructure to get all the production from the shale boom
to market. And so there's been no question in this case that Burlington was imprudent or unreasonable to enter these agreements. Texas Crude has never claimed that. And the only evidence was that we had to sign these in order to get the oil that we ship to market. And in fact, one of the agreements with NuStar, they agreed to construct significant pipelines and terminals to transport our production, but in exchange for this minimum price, of which the deficiency fee is a part. And the case law, while it is sparse, is unanimous that these deficiency fees, and in some contexts they're called firm transportation charges or firm demand charges, that these are deductible transportation post-production costs unless the agreement specifically and expressly limits their deductibility. The only Texas case on point is the commissioner of the GLO versus Sandridge. And it says the issue is not whether firm transportation costs qualify generally as transportation costs. They clearly do. And so they rejected the categorical argument that Texas Crude is making here, that as a matter of law, these types of fees just simply cannot be considered transportation costs. Now, they had to construe what they called the particular language of the particular leases before them, which did expressly address deductibility and limited the deductibility of transportation costs in some respect. Now, whether the El Paso Court of Appeals construction of the leases before it was correct, this court doesn't need to decide because there is no language like that in our assignments. Our assignments do not limit the deductibility
and
at all.
And the agreement here, I'm guessing then, was silent on whether deficiency costs are transportation costs.
Exactly, Your Honor. It provided, as the Supreme Court held, an at-the-well valuation, which the Supreme Court says that means that post-production costs are deductible from the downstream sales price so that you can net it back to get the at-the-well valuation. But there's nothing in the assignments that purported to say you can't deduct particular types of cost, transportation costs. And there's two other cases that are on point. They're federal cases. The Independent Petroleum Association of America versus DeWitt from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that, like the Sandridge case, rejected this categorical rule against deducting deficiency fees. The court there said, on its face, it is hard to see how money paid for assurance of secure transportation is not for transportation. Now, the Sandridge case cited DeWitt for general principles, but it distinguished it as not a contractual dispute. But respectfully, it was. Those were federal leases from the Department of the Interior that incorporated regulations that limited the deductibility of transportation costs. So it was a contractual dispute, and it followed this general rule. And the last case is Jolly Potter Ranches Energy versus TEP, where the court said, and that's a federal district court, said firm transportation contracts and their ensuing demand charges are generally accepted to be transportation expenses that may be charged against the royalty owner. So the case law is uniform on recognizing the deductibility of the type of transportation costs we're talking about here. And Texas Crude urges this court to be an outlier and to be the first to disagree with the case law and the commentary. And I think we've already talked about their main argument is that you're paying for the privilege of not shipping barrels, which no court, no commentator has ever agreed with, and it's contrary to the plain language of the transportation agreements. They also argue that the language that we just talked about, Your Honor, the into the pipeline, which the Texas Supreme Court, the royalty share of production will be delivered into the pipeline. And the Supreme Court has told us that's just telling you it's an at-the-well valuation and you have to deduct post-production costs generally. It is not telling you what, it is not limiting the types of production cost that you can deduct. The same with the amount realized language. The Supreme Court said that the royalty is calculated on the amount realized at the downstream point of sale, and that is just telling you what amount to use. It doesn't affect the deductibility of post-production cost, given the at-the-well valuation. So this is unlike a case where in Sandridge, where they found they had language about that net proceeds meant deducting costs that were actually incurred in the sale of the gas, and the court found significance in that specific language. And commentators have said that Sandridge, that holding was restricted to the fact of the leases before it. So I would respectfully request the court to follow the weight of authority and the standard industry practice and to affirm the summary judgment. Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing the award of fees and expenses that the trial court made under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 215 D relating to our motion for production of documents, and also address the trial court's award of sanctions under Rule 215 3 for abuse of discovery. Those are the that is the issue as to which, as the court knows, Burlington is the appellant. I'd like to then address the deductibility of the deficiency fees, and as the court knows, that's the issue as to which my clients are the appellants. With respect to sanctions assessed under Rule 215, as this court knows, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and the test for abuse of discretion is whether or not Judge Flanagan acted without regard to any guiding rules or principles in making his award. We believe that the answer to that question is no. As you've just heard, Burlington's position is that discovery was stayed, and because discovery in the case was stayed, there was no discovery, and therefore, as a matter of law, Judge Flanagan abused his discretion by awarding discovery sanctions. I want to get into that, but before I do, I want to question from Justice Tiarina. Justice Tiarina, I believe you asked a few minutes ago about the motion for production and whether the motion for production was granted, and I believe you heard from counsel for Burlington that, well, Judge Flanagan instructed us to produce documents. That's incorrect. The motion was presented, it was fully argued. From the bench, Judge Flanagan said, "I am granting the motion for production." And Judge Flanagan didn't instruct Burlington to produce documents. And this came at the end of this 2-year process that we'd gone through to try and get these documents. He didn't instruct them to produce documents. He ordered Burlington to produce documents, and he ordered them to do it within 60 days. And they didn't even do it then. It took them 6 months to produce the documents, and they failed to comply with the order. Now, I said a minute ago that I believe Judge Flanagan did not abuse his discretion, and I'd like to explain to the court why. This morning, we furnished the court with the agreement to stay. I hope the members of the panel have that in front of them. I'd like to spend just a minute talking about this agreement to stay and Burlington's argument that there was no discovery because discovery was stayed. But, saying that all discovery was stayed doesn't make it so. And that's not what happened. And importantly, as we're going to see in a minute, that's not
But
what the parties agreed
isn't
to.
that why you do it? Don't you enter an agreement to stay because you want to avoid some of the penalties and problems that go along with discovery?
Your Honor, that might be the case normally, but here we have a specific agreement to stay. And you'll see in this agreement to stay that this agreement is not just an agreement to stay. This is an agreement to provide discovery during the stay. And if you have that agreement in front of you, if I could direct the
But discovery is a term of art that we can get some definitions from the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And my understanding also that there's a order that the judge said he's granting the joint motion to stay, and it says, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, stay all discovery. So if he's staying all discovery, you could be talking about exchanging information. But I think it's important, or it means something when you're saying discovery, pursuant to the rules.
Your Honor, I also think that pursuant to the rules, if the court looks at the meaning of discovery, that also involves production of documents. And what this agreement to stay is it is a specific agreement for Burlington to produce documents, and under the rules, that constitutes discovery. If the court will look at, if I can direct the court's attention to the opening, if the court will turn to page 2, paragraph 1. Now, the very first paragraph of this agreement to stay, in the opening paragraph, Burlington first agreed to produce documents. And if the court will go to the next page, on page 3, paragraph 3, and I think this is important, this agreement provides, in exchange for Burlington's promise to provide documents, that is, to engage in what the rules define as discovery, that the case would be stayed. And in this agreement, Burlington thus agreed to provide discovery during the stay. As a matter of fact, under this agreement, providing the documents was a prerequisite for the stay. That's what this agreement says. It says, in exchange for Burlington's agreement to provide the documents, the case was stayed. And this agreement is obviously, it obviously, Justice Tijerina, stayed discovery outside of or other than the discovery that this agreement provides for. So Burlington's position that all discovery was stayed, right, is not what the parties agreed to, and it's not what occurred. Burlington's position that Judge Flanagan therefore abused his discretion in awarding discovery sanctions under Rule 215, we believe, is incorrect. I would quickly direct the court's attention to the Plorin case. It's a Dallas Court of Appeals case. It was written by Justice Nathan Hecht when he was on the Dallas Court of Appeals. And in the Plorin case, it's cited in our brief, and if I can give the court the citation, at 755 Southwestern 2nd, 490. The parties entered into a discovery agreement. No formal discovery request was served. And this goes directly to your point, Justice Tijerina, about whether or not a discovery agreement can constitute discovery.
But in that case, discovery wasn't stayed.
That is correct, Your Honor. It was not. And on appeal, the plaintiffs argued that the trial court had abused its discretion in ordering sanctions under Rule 215. The Dallas Court of Appeals disagreed. And this is what was written in that opinion. It says, the Plorins, the plaintiffs, argued that the trial court was not empowered to impose discovery sanctions absent their disobedience of a discovery order or their failure to comply with a proper formal request for discovery. The trial court's power to sanction discovery abuse is not so limited. Neither disobedience of a discovery order nor failure to comply with a formal discovery request is a prerequisite for the imposition of sanctions. In this case, the inspection of the Plorin's home was arranged by agreement. Discovery by agreement is not only permitted, it is encouraged. To fail to enforce undisputed voluntary discovery agreements with the sanctions authorized by Rule 215 would discourage cooperation among parties. Rule 215 expressly authorizes the trial court to impose sanctions when it finds that a party is abusing the discovery process in seeking, making, or resisting discovery. After this, the Dallas Court of Appeals decided, excuse me, this case, the Dallas Court of Appeals issued its opinion in the Hoffman case, which is also cited in our brief. And in the Hoffman case, this was a situation where the trial court entered death penalty sanctions and dismissed the plaintiff's case. The plaintiffs appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed the death penalty sanctions because the conduct occurred before the case was even filed. But in the Hoffman case, the Dallas Court of Appeals reaffirmed our reading of the Florin case. And then the Dallas Court of Appeals in Hoffman said something which I think is very important. And it's just a single sentence. And they're summarizing here their prior opinion in Plorin. In Plorin, the plaintiffs abused the discovery process by resisting discovery which they had agreed to. Right? So you can have a situation. We know what the rules define as discovery. We know that the exchange and production of documents constitutes discovery. We have an agreement to stay that was not just an agreement to stay. It was plainly an agreement to stay all discovery other than what is provided for in this agreement. So, in our view, Judge Flanagan did not act without regard to any guiding rules or principles when he awarded sanctions for discovery abuse. If I could now turn my attention briefly to the award of fees and expenses by Judge Flanagan in connection with our motion for production under Rule 215, 1D. And the first thing I would point out to the court in connection with the judge's award of fees and expenses in connection with our motion for production, we heard from counsel for Burlington that think she addressed the order on plaintiff's recovery of motion for fees and expenses. And the court heard from Burlington a few minutes ago that this order is plainly an order that only grants sanctions under Rule 215.3, that it is not an order that awards fees and expenses under Rule 215.1D in connection with our motion for production. Well, I disagree with that. I've got the order here in front of me. Our motion for fees and expenses undisputably sought fees and expenses attributable to our motion for production under Rule 215.1D. And also separately, fees and expenses for discovery abuse under Rule 215.3. This order that was entered by Judge Franklin, Judge, this order that was entered by the trial court, it says order on plaintiff's motion for recovery of fees and expenses. This order grants our entire motion, this order signed by Judge Flanagan. And our motion again was made under both Rule 215.1D and under Rule 215.3. Under 215.1D for fees and expenses associated with our motion for production, and under Rule 215.3 as an award for sanctions for abuse of discovery. Judge Flanagan granted the entire motion. Now, what we are left with is an attempt by counsel for Burlington to somehow divine the wording in this order and argue to the court that because Judge Flanagan used the word discovery abuse, that this order does nothing other than award fees and expenses that we sought under Rule 215 for abuse of discovery. Well, if we're going to get into try and divining what the words of this order are, other than the fact that Judge Flanagan clearly granted our motion that sought fees under both Rule 215.1 and Rule 215.3, I would point out to the court that nowhere in this order is the word sanctions used. So, if Burlington is attempting to tell this court that Judge Flanagan's entire award of fees and expenses was made for abuse of discovery under Rule 215 to the exclusion of awarding us fees and expenses in connection with our motion for production, I don't buy it. This order grants our motion in its entirety. You know, findings of fact and conclusions of law were not required here, but if Burlington had any question about this, Burlington could have requested findings of fact and conclusions of law. There are authorities in Texas to say doing so in instances like this can provide help to an appellate court. But what we have here is an order that grants our entire motion, and therefore the fees and expenses should be reviewed not just under Rule 215.1D in for fees and expenses in connection with our motion for production, but also fees and expenses that we sought for discovery abuse. If I could turn my attention just briefly to up to this point, I've been talking about the fees and expenses for abuse of discovery under Rule 215.3, and I'd now like to briefly talk about the fees and expenses that Judge Flanagan could have awarded, and we believe he did award in connection with our motion for production under Rule 215-1D. Now, under Rule 215-1D, if a party refuses to permit discovery, the other party may move for an order compelling production. And that's exactly what we did. Rule 215-1D uses the word production and talks about a motion for production. And we filed a motion for production, and it was granted by the trial court. It was granted from the bench. Judge Flanagan said, I'm granting the motion, and I'm ordering these documents to be produced within 60 days. That was by August the 24th. I don't remember what year it was because this has been going on a while. But it wasn't until 6 months, 5 or 6 months later, that we got those documents.
But how do you reconcile all of that with a stay in place? Does the motion just automatically lift the stay, or is a lifting of the stay required by the judge?
I don't believe so. As I said, it all goes back, Justice Tiarina, in my view, to the agreement to stay itself. We know what the definition of discovery is in the rules, as you pointed out. We know that the exchange of documents and the request for documents constitutes discovery. Part of the record in this case and part of our brief is a timeline of events where there are many requests going back and forth for these documents and many objections and so on and so forth going back and forth between the parties. And
But there's benefits to both sides in agreeing to a stay. You're not now, I mean, it's as if you were, like you mentioned in the, I think it was the Howell case, they said, well, this was pre-suit.
Yes.
When you stay, isn't that kind of like what happens? Now you're throwing out the rules, and we'll benefit, they'll benefit, because now we won't have the burdens of the sanctions and the timelines and other things of that nature. I mean, you're benefiting as well by entering into an agreement to stay.
Well, we thought we were. I mean, I go back to the agreement to stay itself, which is the agreement of the parties. And just point out again, it is not an agreement to stay by itself. It is clearly an agreement to stay in exchange for the production of documents, in exchange for Burlington entering into discovery with us and agreeing to produce documents. And the documents they agreed to produce are clearly set forth in the agreement itself. So in my view, as I think I may have mentioned before, the agreement to stay is an agreement to stay all discovery except for the documents that were agreed to have been produced. I think it's pretty clear that that's what the agreement says, Justice Tiarina. With respect to Rule 215-1D, we filed a motion for production. And what I'm talking about here now are fees and expenses that the trial court, Judge Flanagan, awarded in connection with our motion for production. That motion was granted. And under Rule 215-1D, if a motion to compel production is granted, the award of fees and expenses, reasonable fees and expenses, is mandatory under Rule 215-1D. And in my view, that is why Burlington is trying to push this entire war over into 215-3, because it's discretion, it's abuse of discretion standard, which is difficult enough for them. But they don't want this court reviewing this award under Rule 215-1D. Because if it's reviewable under 215-1D, because our motion for production was granted, the award of fees and expenses is mandatory. Right? Now, I'm going to, in a minute, cover the deductibility of deficiency fees. But before I do that, what I have done so far is I have talked about the trial court's award of fees and expenses under Rule 215-1D in connection with our motion for production. I have talked about the trial court's award of fees and expenses under Rule 215-3 for abuse of discovery. And now I'd like to briefly, and the court knows what the standard is here for review of evidence, but I'd just like to point out to the court that a timeline supported by affidavits of events, was furnished by us. The trial court conducted a full evidentiary hearing on its award of fees and expenses. The trial court entertained pre-hearing briefs. The trial court entertained post-hearing briefs. Burlington at the hearing called witnesses. And the fees and expenses that Judge Flanagan awarded under his order granting our fees and expenses under both Rule 215-1D and under Rule 215-3 was barely half of what we sought. And the award was to the penny, which indicates to me a lot of careful consideration by Judge Flanagan in making it. The fees and expenses that we sought were supported by one affidavit after another. Our invoices were furnished. They were color-coded. I furnished an affidavit, not just proving up the invoices as business records, but also proving up our fees and expenses under the Texas Supreme Court's Arthur Anderson opinion and also under the Texas Supreme Court's Warmus opinion. Judge Flanagan did not abuse his discretion, and we believe that the evidentiary basis for Judge Flanagan's ruling is sound. And if I can now turn my attention to this issue of the deductibility of the deficiency fees. As the trial court knows, Burlington made a motion that these deficiency fees are deductible. Judge Flanagan granted that motion. It's our position that Judge Flanagan erred in granting that motion. This case is unusual because we have a Texas Supreme Court opinion in this very case that governs the deductibility of these fees. The Texas Supreme Court, as this court knows, ruled that Burlington is entitled to deduct post-production costs from overriding royalty payments to my clients, and that post-production costs generally include transportation costs. And transportation costs are the cost of transporting the product, in this case, the oil, from the wellhead where it is produced to the downstream location where the product is sold. And here, in this case, those costs would, of course, be the cost of transporting or delivering oil, in which my clients owned an overriding royalty interest from the wellhead to the downstream point at which the oil is sold. According to Burlington, the deficiency fees it deducted are deductible because they are transportation costs. That's Burlington's position. But that isn't the issue. The issue is whether they are transportation costs that are deductible as post-production costs. And the deficiency fees deducted by Burlington were amounts Burlington agreed to pay. We were not parties to those contracts. Burlington entered into contracts with these transporters. And they agreed to pay the transporters on a per barrel basis for barrels of oil that Burlington failed to deliver and that were thus not transported. And let me stop here and quickly say that, you know, it may be that such agreements are common in the industry. But once again, that's not the issue. That's not what we're here about. What we're here about is whether Burlington is entitled to hit us with them, charge them to us. Whether they're common in the industry or not, in my opinion, is irrelevant to this issue. They may be common in the industry. If so, then Burlington may choose to pay those fees itself, rather than pass them along to royalty owners.
Now, just so I understand what these deficiency fees are, Burlington then is contracting with the pipeline to move 100,000 barrels on any particular time period. Are they only shipping Texas crude oil, or are they pooling them with others in order to meet that minimum fee? And if they're pooling with others, are they then attributing percentages to the other people as well, the other producers?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know whether they are or not. I mean, the key with respect to the deficiency fees are that Burlington voluntarily entered into an agreement with these transporters to pay a certain minimum amount. That minimum amount was calculated on a per barrel basis times the minimum amount that Burlington agreed to deliver. If Burlington failed to deliver to be transported that minimum number of barrels, then Burlington nevertheless paid that per barrel fee for each and every barrel that was not transported. Your Honor, the sole ground of Burlington's motion for summary judgment under Rule 166A(b) was that the deficiency fees it deducted are permitted by the parties' agreements, and I'm reading that right out of their motion. According to Burlington's motion, the parties' agreements control whether the deficiency fees are deductible. And according to Burlington, the Texas Supreme Court's opinion, which construed the parties' agreement, sets the framework for whether the deficiency fees are deductible. So this is a bit of an unusual case. We have Burlington acknowledging that the parties' agreements control whether these deficiency fees are deductible and admitting that the Texas Supreme Court's construction of those agreements determines whether these fees are deductible or not. And in its opinion, the Texas Supreme Court found not only that Burlington is entitled to deduct post-production costs, but also the types of post-production costs that Burlington is entitled to deduct. And under the overriding royalty assignment agreements between these parties as construed by the Texas Supreme Court, deficiency fees are not deductible, and here's why. According to the Texas Supreme Court, the overriding royalty assignments required my client's overriding royalty payments to be calculated based on the amount realized from the sale of the product in which my clients own overriding royalty interest. But the summary judgment evidence showed that the deficiency fees deducted by Burlington were for barrels of oil not transported and therefore not sold. According to the Texas Supreme Court, post-production costs that are deductible under the party's overriding royalty assignments include transportation costs expended to prepare raw oil or gas for sale at a downstream location. But the deficiency fees deducted by Burlington were not incurred to prepare oil and gas for sale at a downstream location because the oil in which my clients, Justice Tiarina, own an overriding royalty interest and for which the deficiency fees are being charged to us, was not transported to the downstream location or sold. And according to the Texas Supreme Court, post-production costs that are deductible are to be deducted from the market value of the product at the downstream point where the product is sold. But the deficiency fees that Burlington is charging were per barrel fees for barrels of product not delivered and not sold. Right? Plain and simple. The Texas Supreme Court's opinion, which construed the agreements of the parties that Burlington itself acknowledges, controls whether these deficiency fees are deductible. These deficiency fees are not deductible. As a result, Burlington failed to discharge its summary judgment burden under Rule 166A(b) to show that these fees it deducted were permitted by the parties' agreements. And the summary judgment entered by the trial court on the deductibility of deficiency fees should therefore be reversed. I see that I have a minute and a half left, and I'd like to use it to address a matter that was raised in the parties' briefing, and it relates to deficiency fees. And in Burlington's briefing, there is a comment about the fact that the amount we're talking about here in deficiency fees is some $70,000. The $70,000, I want the panel to know, are the deficiency fees that were uncovered by us during the audit period, which only lasted until the end of December of 2020. There may have been deficiency fees deducted since then. But the significance of the deficiency fee issue in this case is not limited to the $70,000 in deficiency fees that Burlington deducted up through the end of December of 2020. It's not limited to the amount of deficiency fees that Burlington may have deducted since then. It's all about really what Burlington can do in the future in deducting these fees from royalty owners. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? We're good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I will start off by addressing the sanctions issue. First, with respect to the standard of review, as this court well knows, it is required to conduct an independent review of the entire record. The agreement to stay, which Texas Crude relied upon and discussed extensively in its arguments, explicitly states the parties will suspend all discovery. As counsel acknowledged, in the agreement to stay, the parties agreed to conduct an audit. As part of that audit, Burlington did not agree to produce all documents or unspecified documents or anything of the like. To the contrary, as shown in Exhibit A1 to the agreement to stay, the parties clearly listed the documents that Burlington was agreeing to provide. I'll note that that list, which is in the first supplemental clerk's record at page 68, does not use the word invoices. We consistently told Texas Crude throughout the later stage of the audit, we did not believe production of the invoices was required pursuant to the agreement to stay. We nevertheless said, we want to skip to the end, we'll produce the invoices. So it would be incorrect to say that Burlington contractually agreed to conduct discovery or contractually agreed to produce invoices. That is not what happened. Now, with respect to the duration of the stay, everyone agrees that the stay was in place until Burlington asked the trial court to lift it. That did not happen until after the conclusion of the sanctions hearing. The reporter's record reflects everyone understood the stay was in place at that point. The trial court did not enter an order lifting the stay until Burlington made that request. And pursuant to the plain language of the agreement to stay, Burlington's request was the action that needed to occur before the trial court could lift that stay. Now, this case is not Plorin, which is the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion that Texas Crude hangs its hat on. In Plorin, the Dallas Court of Appeals discussed that the parties did not dispute there was an agreement to conduct a specific discovery request, which was an agreement to inspect property. And during the pendency of that discovery request, which you're correct, was during the pendency of live litigation, the plaintiff destroyed the premises that was to be inspected. That was the particular discovery request that was crucial to the court's holding in Florin. And I would like to point out that in Hoffman, the Dallas Court of Appeals said, listen, you cannot take Plorin to mean that discovery is irrelevant for purposes of Rule 215. And in fact, Hoffman reversed an order imposing sanctions because the complaint of conduct did not occur during live pending litigation when there was a discovery request. This case is much more like Hoffman than it is Plorin. I'll also point the court to the Remington Arms opinion out of the Texas Supreme Court, which specifically states Rule 215 applies to pre-trial litigation discovery misconduct. It does not apply to misconduct generally. Rule 215's plain language is cabined to discovery. Now, with respect to whether the trial court sanctions order should be reviewed under Rule 215.3 or Rule 215.1, I will say this court's opinions make clear that if the order tracks the language of the rule, that's the rule the trial that this court should use to review the order. Texas Crude acknowledges that the order uses the term discovery abuse, which is used by 215.3, not 215.1. What I will also say is, while we do agree 215.1 is a fee-shifting award that applies in the event of a motion to compel, it's not just a motion to compel was filed. For sure, that the trial court must impose sanctions. There are certain conditions that must also be met. Again, Texas Crude's motion for production was not a motion to compel, never referred to Rule 215. But additionally, the trial court did not provide Texas Crude the relief it sought in that motion. Texas Crude requested walkthroughs. Texas Crude wanted Burlington to prepare documents. We provided authority. We were not required to do that. The trial court did not order Burlington to produce walkthroughs. What I will say is the court need not reach whether the evidence supports the amount or the fact of the fee award, because the trial court had no authority to award fees. There was no discovery in this case. That is a clear legal question that does not require the court to get into the back and forth regarding the facts. Now, with respect to the deficiency fees, it is important to remember the Texas Supreme Court's holding is that Burlington is required to pay royalty based upon the value of the proceeds at the well. And in order to calculate that amount, Burlington is to calculate the downstream proceeds received and then subtract all amounts required or expenses incurred to achieve those downstream proceeds. Burlington submitted an affidavit in support of its motion for summary judgment on this point.
I'm just thinking about it then. Isn't a deficiency fee then somewhat of like an insurance payment for you? You're taking a gamble that you're going to get so many barrels down, and if you don't, well, then I'm just going to charge it back to the suppliers.
I wouldn't describe it exactly like that. I mean, it truly is.
If you meet your requirements, you don't have to pay them.
No,
or
that's
do you have to pay them?
You do. So, I mean, it is truly a minimum fee. And I will say, we submitted an affidavit from an accountant who is probably going to do a much better job of explaining this than me. That is something that is in the record. And that declaration says a couple of things that I think are important, which is ConocoPhillips only, or Burlington only includes the minimum volume fee, which is what this is, in instances when the transportation is in fact utilized for this production. And Burlington had to sign the contracts with this minimum fee in order to get any capacity on the transportation pipeline at all. The rationale is, and particularly when you look at the time frame in which these transportation agreements were signed, there was not a lot of infrastructure there at the time. So Burlington was looking at a situation where it needed to get its production to market, and it needed to, essentially find someone who was willing to construct the capacity in order to get the production to market. That's obviously requires a very substantial capital investment. So in exchange for agreeing to incur this substantial capital investment, the transporters say, you've got to make this worth my while. You have got to assure me that you are going to pay me this particular rate per barrel, regardless of whether or not you produce X number of barrels or something less than X. Hopefully that makes it a little more clear. What I will say too is the declaration evidence, contrary to counsel's argument, does not say that the fee was incurred for barrels that were not in fact produced. It says directly the opposite to that. And Texas Crew did not provide any evidence to contradict Burlington's declaration testimony. I will just conclude by saying that we ask that the court reverse the trial court sanction order. There is a very clear legal issue presented by that sanctions order. There was no discovery pending. The parties had expressly agreed to avoid discovery in favor of an informal audit process. They did not request a lift of that stay until far after the sanctions were actually in fact awarded. We also request that this court affirm the trial court's summary judgment ruling. The trial court's summary judgment ruling was consistent with all of the authority that has decided this issue thus far.
Thank you.
Trying to put it in my little head. The Texas Crew then faces more deductions with less, if Burlington transport less oil, then Texas Crude faces more deductions per gallon. Is that?
No. And that's where the minimum aspect comes into play. So the way the contracts work is Burlington agrees. This is the fee. I'm just going to pull a number out of thin air. So we'll pay $1 per barrel in order to transport oil on your facilities. And if Burlington transports less than the specifically contemplated quantity, Burlington still has to pay that dollar per barrel fee.
Right. And then that gets passed down to Texas Crude and the other people that are having oil transported, right?
To the extent that occurs. So without getting too far into the weeds on the accounting, the way it works is Burlington tracks where each barrel of sugarloaf production is the production we're arguing about here. So Burlington tracks where each barrel of sugarloaf production goes. And once Burlington gets to the point at which that particular production is sold, it then looks at all of the transportation expenses incurred with respect to that production, calculates a per barrel transportation rate, and then multiplies that by the number of barrels produced from each sugarloaf well. So there is not an allocation, nor does Texas Crude argue in this case that they have borne a post-production cost that was not attributable to their wells. Does that help?
Kinda.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer any other
questions. Thank you. This case will be under submission.